I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to Unfiltered with James O'Brien, brought to you by Joe.
Hello and welcome to Unfiltered with me, James O'Brien. I'm about to introduce you to someone whose name you will recognise, but about whom I don't think you'll know very much apart from Brexit. Gina Miller, businesswoman, campaigner, and the lead challenger legally of the government on that determination to make Parliament vote on triggering Article 50. She's written a book. It's called Rise, Life Lessons in Speaking Out, Standing Tall, and Leading the Way. And, well, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm at risk of being a bit of a fanboy on this one. Three years ago, it strikes me that most people listening to this wouldn't have had a clue who you are.
Well, in certain sectors, they would have known who I was. In the dry world of investments and pensions, where I've been campaigning.
Yes, I should tell you, Unfiltered is not...
exactly.
It's not targeted uniquely or specifically at the world of investment and pensions.
No, but maybe the charity sector a bit more, because I've been pretty robust in what I've been saying, calling out some of the dubious behaviours there. But generally, no, I don't think most people would have known.
You'd achieved, a commercial prominence and success, but also politically. You were involved, I think, in helping draft the 2015 manifesto for...
On pension reform, in the 2015 manifesto, which never was, obviously, because they didn't win. But no, I have been politically involved in that, and also Centre for Social Justice, the modern day slavery bill. So I've been pretty active for quite a few years, but behind the scenes.
Yes, no desire, what we call the look at me gene. There was never any sort of show off element to what you were doing.
It was just an awful lot of work to be done.
Yes.
And then suddenly I found myself in the spotlight. And what people don't realise is that I had no intention of being in the spotlight.
We're jumping the gun. We'll get on to that. I want to begin at the beginning. And the beginning is British Guyana, daughter of your father, became at the beginning of this millennium the Attorney General of Guyana. I don't know much about British Guyana. Is that a common ignorance?
It is not only that, but people say, oh, well, you go back to Ghana. And I go, no, that's in a different continent.
Yes.
That's Africa. Mm. But British Guyana, I think maybe the things people know it most for is cricket. We had some great cricket players, Clive Lloyd, etc. But the other thing is that it's where the Queen and Prince Philip went on honeymoon.
Yes, cool.
And then the other thing is possibly El Dorado might be in British Guyana. Demerara sugar, there are a few things, but in general, most people don't know. It's a very small country.
And this is a fascinating background, isn't it? Because the word British in British Guiana is, for people from there, of absolutely paramount importance. So there's a flavour of Windrush to this ignorance that we have in this country, whereas people who grew up there sort of presume we have a sense of kinship or cousinhood as opposed to ignorance.
I mean, my memories of growing up is, you know, the picture of the Queen was on the wall.
Yes.
My mother's most precious things were her English Wedgwood plates. if we got chocolate from the UK that said Cadbury's. We grew up with such a love and respect for Britain. And the fact that we would be welcomed with open arms, because it was like Britain was our mother and we were the children of the Commonwealth. And so everything we did was in reverence of Britain.
I think this is one of the biggest lessons that people need to learn. I mean, it's probably too late now for some of the problems that have been caused. But there's a great line in Andrea Levy's book, Notes on a Small Island, about a fellow from the West Indies who his brother had been killed in the Second World War as a pilot. So he presumed when he arrived here that they'd roll out the red carpet. Mm. And the reality, of course, is incredibly different, as you discovered when you came here to go to boarding school.
It was different because I thought, ironically, as I said, El Dorado, thought Britain was El Dorado.
Yes, exactly.
And I was going to El Dorado, and it was going to be all the things I was so dreamed of reading in, you know, Dickens books. And I grew up on all of those books and the Famous Five, and, you know, everything I read was English and British, and that's where I wanted to go. And I remember thinking how grey the buildings were. It wasn't this sunshine place I was expecting. And also people seemed to be much more reserved and didn't accept me, didn't open their arms, which is what we all thought. We sent everything we produced from British Guiana to England. It was going to be this sort of happy family coming home. And that's, you know, first of all, I sounded differently. My accent then was very different. I looked different. And everyone sort of, it was what made me different seemed to be the things that people concentrated on, rather than the fact that I had come from a neighbouring country that loved us and we, you know, would be loved.
Isn't that interesting? Because some of the people that you've ended up opposed to, quite passionately opposed to, they also had a slightly rose-tinted vision of Britain. And they also grew up overseas. You're sort of Daniel Hannan's and that dreadful Carswell character. and yet they cling to their dream of what it was probably never like. It hadn't occurred to me before.
It's a really interesting, it's a storybook version
That's
of Britain.
That's right, yes, which it's, you understood which and you I, had, but you quickly jettisoned.
Well, when I came here, I realised that actually there were things I absolutely loved about Britain and I wanted to embrace and become British in every way I could. But I didn't do it blindly. It was about me making the best of what I could be, but also introducing an understanding, if I could, from British people who had never left and gone to my country.
Yes.
And that's what I was really interested in doing, is having that conversation. Whereas I don't think other people have necessarily had that. They still have this sort of storybook view of what Britain is and should be like.
Yes, it's interesting. You mentioned Enid Blyton and more so than Dickens, but it's boys' own stuff, isn't it?
It's comic
book stuff for people.
It's a swashbuckling. I think that's
right.
The whole thing.
Yes.
The whole idea of, you know, we can go out in the seas, and it's a very backward-looking way. What I find so ironic about where we are is that for different reasons, both extremists on both sides, left and right, want to take us back to a place that never really existed. It's quite an irony.
And where you mention the word swashbuckling, it leads inexorably to the word Brexit.
Yeah.
As opposed to Brexiter, but we're jumping the gun again. Home was very political. You were surrounded by political people and political issues growing up, but you wouldn't have known that that was extraordinary or abnormal because it was all you knew.
It's all I knew, and political in both a big P and a small P,
yes,
in that every day our conversations were about people and justice and helping each other and duty and responsibility. Those were things that both my parents were very passionate about. And in a big P, because we were going through a very challenging time, you know, we talk about divisions between even Remain in the UK and division. In British Guiana at the time when we got independence, it was very much against the black and the Indians and the different races. So we had a huge racial divide.
Right.
And the civil unrest that was causing, and literally the murders it was causing at the time when my father was starting his career, meant that he was very much in the thick of it, being a young lawyer and a human rights lawyer at that time. So every day, every conversation was about right and wrong, about justice, about people, about pain. So I don't know any different. It was
something. Were you conscious of danger at an early age?
Was your father
a controversial figure?
My father was very vocal in standing up. My father's daughter. He said you had to speak up for other people.
Right.
If they were too frightened, too weak, you had a responsibility, if you have a voice, to speak up. And that's something he taught me at a very young age. So he spoke up against our dictator, against our government. And there was always this feeling that we were going to be targets, I think, growing up.
And that perhaps explains something of your political genesis on this side of the world.
none of this is a surprise to me.
No.
Where I am today is not a surprise
to me.
That's
what makes you so interesting, because it's staggering to almost everybody else. On your side, our side.
I just think it was exactly where I should supposed to be. There's something, when I say I'm quite fatalistic, I think, well, of course it's me.
Yes.
And I remember sitting in the law firm when the sort of other two who were going to bring the case with me sort of fell away for their own reasons. Mm. It wasn't an issue to me. I said, well, of course it's supposed to be me, and of course I'm going to carry on.
Let's talk a little about what had put you in a position where you could be that person who elected to carry on. School was a bit miserable, as far as I can tell. You were bullied. You experienced racism for the first time.
Yeah. It was very nuanced. It was not...
Was it a girls' boarding school?
It was a girls' boarding school, and it wasn't what I'd call racism. It was just being treated as different.
Yes, okay.
And I don't necessarily think that's just because of my colour or anything else. It's just because I was different.
It could have been spectacles or ginger hair.
Yeah. I was just different. So I don't think I'd call that racism or bullying. You know, I was in Eastbourne, which is a very traditional part of Britain. Mm. I was in a metropolitan city.
How did your parents choose the school?
An interesting one.
Yes.
I think the combination of British Guiana, or Guiana, is very well known for its flora and fauna and its animals and frogs. And there are these two incredible brothers who came over to do a book on snakes and insects. And my mother had met them, and they happened to be teaching. They're from Eastbourne. They were from Eastbourne. And we were talking, my parents were talking about, and they said to them, they were called the Marx brothers, funny enough,
yes.
They wanted a really caring school.
Right.
So they'd looked through the brochures and got Rhodey and all the big schools. And they said they were worried because I'd never been away from home ever.
Yes.
That they wanted a small, caring place. And they found this tiny school for my mother.
You were 11 when you arrived
there. I was 11, yes.
Do you remember the first night? That kind of...
I remember
sense of dislocation.
I remember this huge trunk that I had to pull up the steps of the boarding of the room to get into the hall, and just standing there and feeling how it was actually a boiling hot summer, 76. And I remember feeling that I didn't recognize anything. Nothing was familiar to me, even though I'd read all about it in books. Mm. Nothing in reality seemed familiar to me. I thought I knew England growing up, and I realized I actually didn't know anything about the England I was standing in, that room. And when my mother said to me she had to leave, I just wouldn't let her go. Oh. I just remember that feeling of thinking, but you can't leave me here. This is not England I was supposed to come to.
Yes.
I had a very different view in my mind of where the school I was going to go to.
Did your parents give you an escape route? Did they say if you're miserable after 6 weeks, 6 months, you could come home?
It was
quite brutal.
It was brutal. My sort of safety net was my elder brother. So he was 2 years older than me.
And
he was in Eastbourne at Eastbourne College. So he was down the road. So, and you know, we were pretty close fighting. We had the usual sort of scrappy relationship that brother and sister have, but we were each other's comfort, and he was down the road.
Did you want to leave? Did you want to go home?
Oh, many times.
Yeah.
I cried. I phoned on a Sunday. You'd have letters written. The thing is with the letters, we couldn't seal them. The staff had to read them before they went home. So I think the ones where I was really distressed, they never let me send.
God, really?
No.
I went to boarding school as well. It's almost, even for our generation, it's almost impossible to believe what we took to be normal.
Yes.
Isn't it? In terms of, I mean, there was a lot of casual brutality at my old boys' school, particularly my prep school as opposed to my public school. But a modern listener will find it astonishing that an 11-year-old girl's misery would not be communicated to her parents because it made the people in charge of deciding what got sent look bad.
Yes, so they wouldn't. And also even things like, I remember getting my BCG jab and feeling really terrible, but I wasn't allowed to go to sick bay for more than one day because, you know, we had to be tough.
Weakness.
We had to be tough. And it was this whole idea of you have to be tough and survive. And I had really, really long hair. I remember that went past my bottom, and I'd have 15 minutes in the freezing cold to wash, get my hair dried, and done.
Yes.
And in the end, it wasn't a question of giving me more time or me not getting sick or getting a head cold, whatever. It was just, no, fine, you have to cut your hair off then.
That'll be it.
And brutal, you know. One plait.
Yes, gone.
Gone.
Seriously?
Yes.
Did they let you keep it?
I did, actually, for years later.
It was a dressing gown for them.
It was nearly long enough to do that. But it wasn't peculiar things I remember that I had to use a knife and fork, but the fork the right way around.
Yes.
And I'd never come across peas.
Right.
But I had to put peas, and I turned my fork around the other
way.
As
you would.
And the next minute I'd get a ruler on the knuckles that wasn't the proper way to use your knife and fork. I'm thinking, goodness.
What is going on?
These were normal things that we had to do.
Well, they were. They were normal in the sense of they'd been normalised.
They'd been normalised.
Were there any positives?
Oh, I loved being with the other girls.
Did you?
Because I had three brothers. Yes. And so I didn't have real sort of a connection to the girls. And once I had good girlfriends, and that was brilliant. And I loved the school bit, was very peculiar in many ways, because it was started by a general who wanted to educate his daughters. So he didn't see girls as wanting to achieve any less than boys.
Right.
So I loved the science, and I loved yes. maths, and I loved the fact that we could play cricket and rugby. And we were pretty tough girls.
Yeah.
And
so
I
it was
loved
quite ahead
that.
Of its time in some
yeah, it
ways.
Was. It was very progressive. It was always known as a really incredibly progressive school. And we were sort of slightly maladjusted girls and things like that, because we basically thought we could run the world. And, you know, we were taught that every day.
The planets were aligning.
Yeah, they were. And so it was the right school for me. However really? My parents found it, it yes. was definitely the right place for me.
Why would it be important to people like your parents to educate you and your brothers in Britain? What would be
the... Oh, my gosh, that was the pinnacle. If yes. there's anything you could do to get your children to a British education, educated in England was seen as basically like winning a gold medal in the Olympics. And so my parents, whatever it took, they would scrimp, save, whatever it is, because we were going through a couple of years later, currency restrictions. Mm. They did everything. I mean, I think if I worked it out, my parents probably paid three times as much in fees than they should have.
Gosh.
Because it was on a black market. The
sure.
currency they were buying was on the black market. But they would have done anything to have us educated in the UK.
Because of what they wanted you to achieve in later life, because they saw it as a passport rather than an end in itself in some sort of snobbish way. It was,
oh, no, it's not.
This is your golden ticket.
No. It was nothing about snobbery. It was about the fact that if you could get a British education, if you could get the learning and the culture and the music and all the things it exposed you to, you could do anything in the world. And it was never their intention that we would stay. It was just to have the education and go back and be leaders or do the things you were going to do in life. It was seen as a bedrock of making you the best person you could be.
Yes. But you didn't go back.
I didn't go back because by the time you're 18, you're British, and then you go to university, and then suddenly all those formative years, you're suddenly British. So at the age of 18, 19, I said my parents did try to get me to go back, especially my father, because his great dream was that I was going to take over his practice.
Right.
So, you know, his dream was...
None of your brothers?
No.
So that's a lot of people in your life, the school and the dad who refused to see your being a woman as being in any way an obstacle or a distinction from men.
No, my father never treated me as though I was different from the boys. He always said you could be anything. And he gave me such confidence from a very young age, because he always told me from a very young age, he told me, you are special and you have a good heart. And I believed that. Why wouldn't I? He was my father telling me this.
Yes.
So I believed in myself from a very young age because he gave me the ability to do that, which is really, really important.
So if we met you then at 18, 19, what would your ambitions have been? So what do you want to be? What do you want to do? What are you aiming for?
I wanted to be the most amazing criminal barrister.
Okay.
That's what I was going to do. I was going to become the first female, you know, judge in the UK. I had huge ambitions for my legal profession. So I wanted to be extremely successful in law.
What happened?
I started studying at university. And just before my finals, I was attacked. And I had to take some time out. And I sort of taking that time out, I lost faith in the barriers that were even put up for me to get into the British. Because we were talking about, you know, 80s here, and it wasn't that welcoming to a woman, a young girl of colour, not going to the right boarding school, not going to the right university. You know, it was pretty
because
closed
you'd have
profession.
Because you'd have to get a pupillage.
Exactly. You needed to know people. You needed to have gone to the select group of public school, the right public school, the right university to get into those chambers in London to get the pupillage. And more and more barriers seemed to be appearing. And then I was feeling so weak and so broken by the attack.
Can I ask about that? What was...
It was a sexual attack, and it took me a long time to recover from it.
Okay. So someone you knew? Or
it was some guys from the college, from the university. But I just didn't know where to go, and I kept it secret for many years because I just felt shame.
Of course.
As so many victims, I thought it was my fault. I'd done something wrong, and you blame yourself. So I just hid more than anything.
For
a long time. And then I discovered something, because one thing that's really interesting in the book is that I'm not the sort of person who tends to look backwards. I sort of pick myself up and carry on.
In the course of this interview, every time I try and encourage you to look backwards, you start talking about now.
I'm not great at doing it, and it's quite an uncomfortable thing for me to do, only because I want to move forward.
Of course.
But what I discovered writing the book is that I did something I didn't know I'd done, in that I had set up this goal of wanting to be the successful barrister and make my father proud. And I think a way I hid from what happened to me is I decided to shut down that part of my life and those ambitions and go on a different path, that I could be someone different, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does make sense.
So I decided that Gina was going to shut down, the one who was the lawyer, who was going to be the ambitious lawyer, was going to close down. And I was going to go and do something completely different.
Because your world was shaken so profoundly.
Exactly.
Your place in it shifts as well.
And also my place in it, my confidence, everything sort of went. And so I thought I could reinvent myself in a new world, in a different world that was, to me at the time, a bit more frivolous.
Yes.
Because I was very serious about the law. But I saw business and starting businesses as being, wrongly, as I learned, but as being a little bit more, you know, you can take more risks, it's a bit more frivolous. So I thought, well, I'll go into the world of business. And so I then invented, well, a different Gina who went into that world.
Did you have a desire to be wealthy?
Oh, gosh, no.
Never?
No. Which has been my saviour, actually, I think, because it's allowed me to walk away at times when I needed to from very bad relationships without anything. So I've never had a problem with leaving with nothing. I mean, money's not important to me.
Your first marriage was at 21.
Yeah.
So that speaks of a fairly determined decision to embark upon an entirely fresh course.
It was a fresh course.
Because Gina, the lawyer,
wouldn't
have been getting married until she'd got her, probably...
Exactly. Yeah, no. If ever, actually.
Yes.
But then it was like, it was somebody that I'd known sort of since 16. So, you know, this is somebody I trusted. Mm. So it was a good relationship. But marriage was never particularly important to me. Being a mother was always very important to me. So then new Gina, new life, husband, and a baby soon after. So, you know, then and a business. And so there was a new, if you like, new journey to
and
charter.
Did it work? Because it sounds
No, it didn't work.
No, because you're building up barriers to keep the past away from you.
Well, no, because what you do is you're then not really being yourself.
Right.
And I discover that I can't keep down my true me for too long.
What does that mean? What do you mean?
The really ambitious, vocal, standing up for what's right, calling things out. That's just the really annoying me.
So you couldn't just get on with running businesses or making money. We call it social justice.
Yeah.
Social justice is in
it's
your DNA.
It's always there in the back of my mind, nagging, you know, anywhere I saw it, I'd call it out. And I didn't know at the time that actually the thing, and I say it and I absolutely believe this, the person who saved me and brought me back to who I am, the fighter that I am, is actually my daughter.
Yes.
Because I was so happy to be a mother. I was just delighted that I was going to have this wonderful baby girl. But the NHS was failing. There was no one to deliver her. And she was starved of oxygen. Mm. So she had quite complicated special needs. And I had to fight for her.
Right.
So she helped me rediscover myself.
Except that it was someone you loved that you were fighting for, rather than...
Yes.
You know, the kind of people you will never meet.
Well, no, not really, because I was fighting for her, for somebody I loved, as you say. So, I mean, you know, my whole world. But I knew that if I fought for her in a certain way to get statements, to get a different way that schooling provided for special needs, that it wasn't just about her, I knew it would help everybody. So, you know, my first big battle with a local authority was to ensure that children got statemented from the age of 4 or 5.
I didn't know that about you.
Okay.
And so you kicked a door open through which then anyone can pass.
Yes, because it was very, very hard to get statements in those days, because local authorities knew that would be a commitment till 18.
Right.
And it was gold dust to get a statement. So that was my first really big battle to get her help.
So I'm just intrigued by the, can I use the word domesticity? That's not quite right, is it? Maternal instinct, your fierce maternal instinct, which reinvigorated your kind of political consciousness. But so was it possible around this period? You were 23 when your little girl was born. Could you have stayed at home? Or was it always going to be coupled with business?
Yeah, I just could never have stayed at home.
So, there wasn't an attempt to do that when you were trying to reinvent yourself. You were never trying to become a kind of housewife?
No, because, I mean, my mother had given up her dreams, had it become a housewife.
Right.
And she was, you know, in those conversations and those times, my father would be there with all these important people having important conversations. She'd be serving the drinks or making the snacks or whatever. And I never saw myself as doing that.
No.
I wanted to be part of the conversation.
She probably didn't either when she was 18.
She was very happy doing that. She was very happy being a mother and a housewife. And
would she have wanted that for you?
No, never. Wow. And she knew that I would never have actually given it any credence anyway. There was an opportunity for me to go back, be married to the right son of the right family and have a career path. And, you know, she just looked at me after she said it one day and went, "You're not going to say yes, are you?" And I would never have said yes. I just can't ever have imagined I would have been a stay-at-home mother, even though I think it's actually probably the most important job a woman can do. It just wasn't for me. I wanted to be a mother, but also to go out there and fight. But my mothering instinct is not just about my children.
No.
I sort of feel responsibility for anyone I come across. My people who work for me, I just feel responsible.
Yeah, I get that. A lot of people don't. And a lot of people who don't get it have a problem believing that it's true. Don't they?
I mean,
this brings us back into
the
Brexit arena.
Yeah.
It's almost like a limb that you either have or you don't have.
Well, it's an interesting thing because very early on when I was getting a lot of abuse from the right-wing press, I actually asked a journalist who works for one of them. I said, "So why are you going after me in this way?" And they said, "Because you're too good to be true. There's got to be something about you. We're determined to find the skeleton in your closet." And I said, "But just come and ask me."
Yes.
And so that term, he said, "You're just too good to be true." It's almost as though nobody's going to believe this.
Because they have to believe, and it's a mark of the right-wing press, they have to believe that there's a darkness in everybody's soul reflects the darkness in their own.
And I said to him, "Your statement you've just made says more about you than it does about me."
Doesn't it? And yet you were on good enough terms with them to...
I've always gone out of my way to speak to them because I don't understand talking to people who disagree with me.
No, of course.
I really don't understand it.
No, well, it makes a mockery of this interview.
But you have to go out there. You have to just be...
You don't, Gina. You don't have to do,
I do.
What would happen if you didn't? Would you be like a sort of... a greyhound stuck in the stall while all the other dogs were sprinting around the track and you'd just be throwing yourself against the doors?
My husband said this about me soon after meeting me. He said, "If the ants could talk, you'd be lying on the floor talking to them." And it is absolutely true. And I just need to know. I mean, as a little girl growing up, I was the most annoying little girl at school. I never took anything the nun said as gospel. I questioned them all the time about everything. It's just who I am.
Yes. And yet that is the thing that's hardest to communicate to people who don't get it. People will either get it without having to have it explained or they'll never get it despite...
Which is fine. Some people never get it.
Yeah.
And absolutely, that's fine.
You mentioned your husband. That's your third husband.
Yes. So, I got it wrong lots of times, twice before.
So the first marriage didn't work out despite the fact that you'd found a happiness in some senses that you weren't expecting or certainly hadn't planned on.
I did, and that was because of the stress on the relationship when you have a child with special needs. And I dedicated myself to her because I didn't believe the doctors and what they were saying. So they were limiting her. They were saying she couldn't do this. She wouldn't be able to be independent. She wouldn't. And I thought, well, I'm not going to listen to any of you. She's going to be the best that she can be.
Yes.
Which meant I had to dedicate myself to make sure that she could be the best that she could be.
To the exclusion of all else.
To the exclusion of all else.
Right.
Because, you know, you can only put so much energy in, you know, and I taught her to walk. I taught her to speak. I taught her to do everything that she can do. And that took a lot of dedication and time. And so, you know, literally putting her foot, one foot in front of the other in a playground relentlessly every morning so she could learn to climb, to go down the slide, so she'd have that reward of going down the slide.
What made you think you could do that? Especially if the medical advice was contrary, what made you think?
I didn't know that she could do it. I just thought, I'm going to try and see. I'm just going to try.
So every improvement you see justifies the next
attempt.
And the next attempt.
And the next and the next.
And while this was happening, you could feel your marriage slipping away.
I don't think I even knew it. It just happened one day because he just felt it. And also the other thing I've discovered, and over the years I've now discovered this as well, because I do a lot of work with parents, kids with special needs, is that there is this pride that you have as a father. And he found it quite difficult to accept that his daughter wasn't like the other children, his friends' children. She wasn't reaching them. It was sort of a sense of embarrassment. Mm. And he was an incredibly proud person. And that's just who he is. And I can't say that he was wrong to feel that or right. It's just what happened. So he was feeling neglected by me. and I was neglecting him. And also he found it difficult emotionally to accept Lucianne and her difficulties and almost ashamed of her.
Yeah.
Because Eastbourne is a very small community and, you know, everyone knows everyone else and everything else. And so I just decided it was easier for me to walk away.
It couldn't hold.
And also I just couldn't cope with his baggage he needed to deal with.
Yeah.
And so we just drifted apart.
So now, instead of being the youngest QC in British legal history, you're a single mother of a child with profound...
With special needs, yes.
With
so nobody
needs.
can identify, really.
And how are you then juggling that with your need to work and your need... I mean...
I didn't quite know what I was going to do next.
So where are we now? This would
so
be...
I was back in... So I then moved to London when Lucianne was five. So she was born in 1988.
So you're 28
yeah,
at this
yeah.
point.
So okay. I moved back to London. I decided, actually... What I'd do is I'd go back to university.
Right.
I discovered...
Unfinished business as well.
Unfinished business, but not the law.
No.
I thought that I'd actually discovered a business and marketing, and I realised that I actually had quite a flair for communications and marketing. So I thought, well, it would be good to have a professional qualification in it.
Right.
So I then enrolled in London and did a marketing degree.
And how did Lucianne fit into that?
So what happens is you get lectures that are repeated for matured students.
Right.
So whenever I could, I'd work wherever I could. And then I would take her with me in the evenings to lectures. And I just somehow managed to do it. But she was just with me whenever she could and as much as she could be.
And then there was another marriage.
Yep.
Which, from what I know of it, is the hardest bit to understand in some ways of your story. Because the chap you married has gone on the record opposing multiculturalism and being fairly critical of homosexuality as well.
Yeah. I can't say, I mean, this all, I found out about all of this after years after we divorced, but it is quite extraordinary because I think there was always a part of me that felt guilty that Lucianne didn't have both parents.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yes,
because I'd grown up with an incredible father.
Yes.
And there was always a part of me that felt guilty that she didn't have a father. And so I came across this very charismatic, incredibly successful Irishman who is very smart, who had three children who loved them. And I thought, my gosh, he purports to love me. He purports to love my daughter. And here is sort of a family that she can have. So everything was attractive about it, about the relationship. And I felt that this was somebody I loved and he could love me. And everything about it seemed right. But I didn't know. I didn't know until after we got married his true intention. Or I don't even know if he knew the true intention. But for whatever reason, the things that, I mean, I've never spoken about this because I ran away, literally ran away from the marriage.
How long after getting married?
A couple of years.
That's
because
the penny dropped very quickly then.
Yeah, because it was almost the things that attracted me to him were the things he then wanted to break. It was almost he needed to own me. And so he just basically set about breaking me down. And
the scale of the challenge was part of the attraction then, because you would be such a difficult person to own or to break down.
I think there was a challenge there that he sort of, if I could be obedient almost,
right,
then he had won a trophy in some way. It was a very strange mindset. And I now know, again, from years of working now with people from domestic violence, that it's not uncommon.
Right.
It's quite an extraordinary relationship that develops between a strong woman and a man that then abuses her. It's a challenge to break you. It's very, very intricate, but it's
intertwined. There's a logic to it.
There is a logic to it, and there's also
a warped logic,
a warped logic. But you can see how it happens.
Of course.
And I think one of the things I say is that one of the criticisms that's put towards women is that why didn't you leave earlier? Why didn't you ask for help? And I say, but if you are so broken that you have no recognition of who you are, and you are emotionally crippled, how can you possibly ask for help?
Hmm.
And that's the thing I discover is when you are that broken, you can't. It is impossible. You have to somehow find the strength to ask for help. And for me, again, it was my daughter.
Right.
Because I knew I had to protect her.
She can't live like this.
She couldn't live like that. And I had to get out to be strong enough to look after her.
Are we back at school? Is this part of the reason why you the character form is if you put up with the adversity? And if your daughter hadn't been there, you almost would have felt that you were admitting defeat or failing?
No, I don't think. No, I've never had a problem with failing. Failing is okay. I've never had a problem with that. I think it's I would have probably stayed longer. I'm a fighter, so I would have stayed longer to make it work. I think that's what would have changed, would have been different, is that I would have fought.
And it wouldn't have worked.
Right? It wouldn't have worked. but I would have stayed longer discovering that. I think it was a shorter period of time because I had to get out for her.
Out to where? I mean, so again, you're a single mother with a daughter.
Well,
who needs
for that
you.
Point, yeah, with nothing because, you know, I left with nothing.
Did
both
you really?
Times. Both times. I literally got divorced in about 6 weeks
yes.
and took nothing.
Why
and,
not? You could have done, presumably. Or
yeah, but what's the point? Fighting.
I see, yes.
I needed all my energy. I needed all my energy, all my strength, and all my focus for her and to rebuild. And that's where I was focused on. And I know that I have the strength and the ability to earn. It doesn't matter how.
You knew that now because we've been...
No, I've always known that.
Because there was a brief period of chambermaiding, which was quite a formative experience for you as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, no. At school, I mean, when my parents sort of said, you know, we have currency restriction, we won't be able to get money to you. We'll probably just have enough money to pay day fees, but that's it. You and your brother are going to have to find... No pocket money, nothing like that. You know, I knew I'd just go and get myself a job.
This is such an interesting contradiction because, isn't it? Because you seem to... have spent very little time administering to your inner life, your emotional needs. So you've ended up in two potentially dysfunctional relationships, and yet your role in the world and your determination to find a role in the world is complete. Do you think perhaps you haven't been kind enough at this point, because we're now reaching 2002. Mm. You haven't been very kind to yourself.
That's what I discovered writing the book.
Is it?
I hadn't actually ever thought about it. What I realised that I did, and I often do, is I just roll my sleeves. I get on with it.
Yes, exactly.
Which means I don't actually give myself the space to almost mourn for my own losses.
Yeah.
And that's something I had to learn to do later on in life. But I just didn't think I didn't have the time to do that. I just needed to get on and do things. And it wasn't until much later that I'm only learning to do it now. I'm not particularly good at looking after myself. And I always have to remind myself, it's a joke I told at a school, at the sixth form. And now I use it to remind myself. And I said, the thing is, if Martin Luther hadn't gone to sleep, he would have never had a dream.
That's your own.
Yeah,
that's brilliant. That's going in the dictionary of quotations, isn't it?
So, so now I remind myself that I have to sleep so that I can actually recharge myself to go on and have to fulfill the dream. So I said it as a bit of a quip to kids, and I actually now use it on myself to remind myself that I need to sleep and stop.
Of course, because otherwise you will run out. You will expire.
I will expire. And also I realise that I have quite a lot I can do now. I think now what's really interesting about where I find myself now and the platform I now have, because I have the privilege of having that platform, I need to take care of myself so that I can use it.
Ah, yes.
And that's something I've not done in the past.
No, I get that. I mean, it's not unlike a kind of an artist who's lived a fairly irresponsible life, realising that if they're going to continue making art, they have to start looking after the instrument.
Yes, and it's really interesting you use the word irresponsible because...
I didn't mean that in the context of your
existence. No, it's interesting because one of the criticisms of my book that's already come out from very few people who've read it is... there are lots of things that have happened to you in your life. Is that because you're really irresponsible and you take risks?
Gosh.
I thought, no, I didn't deliberately set out to take risks.
You didn't think you were jumping off a cliff.
I didn't. What I did do is pick myself up and carry on. But it's interesting that interpretation that if you somehow have an eventful life for whatever reason, you've taken risks.
Of course.
It's peculiar to me, that view.
Well, you can see where it comes from, but of course, your risks have ultimately paid off. So we're now at the 2002. Your second divorce kicks in, and this is where the journey to today begins.
Yes.
So
because I just decided this is now going to be about me achieving and doing what I wanted to do.
Yes.
So I start another business. My daughter.
Are you wealthy now? I mean, had your other businesses gone well? Could you have jacked it all in and lived comfortably for the rest of your life?
No, because I walked away from everything.
So that was it?
To stay safe,
yes,
I needed to walk away from everything.
Okay.
I couldn't allow any sort of way back into my life but for my ex-husband. I decided that the way to save myself was to walk away completely.
Okay, and so you extracted yourself financially, emotionally, physically, mentally.
Everything, yes. Apart from a car and two suitcases, that was it.
Okay, so now you start again.
I started again.
What did that involve?
So I started the consultancy, walked into several of the places on Harley Street and said, this is my business, this is my CV. I managed to persuade, I'm a great Oscar Wilde fan, I'd managed to persuade the estate that I could use his signature as our logo. So I started a company called Wilde Marketing, and it's all about being talked about, and walked into Harley Street and ended up with three clients to do their marketing, a dentist, a plastic surgeon, whatever, and got going. In 7 months, I had seven clients.
Is why you talk so casually about knowing you could do it. Even then, you sort of think, I'll do that. That'll be fine.
Yeah. I just set up the business.
And you've got that fearlessness, because I hate knocking on doors. I can't do it. I fear rejection. You don't. Because you've already established robustly. You've got no problem with failure.
No. And also, this is the way I view it. What are the downsides?
Yeah.
They'll say no.
What's the worst that could happen?
What's the worst that can happen? And, those are pretty good odds. It tends to be yes, no, or maybe. Those are pretty good odds as far as I'm concerned.
Yes.
And so, just go on and do it.
So the consultancy goes brilliantly.
Yep.
Then you meet your third husband, Alan, with whom you set up the company that sort of pushed your financial situation into the stratosphere.
Mm-hmm. So it was just after the financial crisis.
Yeah, okay. So this is all relatively recent, isn't it?
In the context of
your life.
Yeah. So when the consultancy that I set up while marketing became successful, I realized then it was my money, I could do what I wanted with it, and became quite successful quite quickly. And so I used that money to then get involved in social justice. So that's when I started using my money.
Had that always been bubbling away in the background? Was that, so I know I will get round to this one day, but I currently have to sort this out and this out and this out.
I needed to. It wasn't about being successful to get rich. It was about being successful. I needed enough money to go and do the things I wanted to go and do.
Right. So you had a sense of mission.
Oh, yeah. No. Absolutely.
But I love the way you say it as if it's a silly question. It's not a silly question for other people.
It's just, broadly speaking, I have quite big ambitions of what I want to do. And I just needed to get there and earn enough money to do that. And that's exactly what I'm going to do.
And so there's your consultancy, and then there's the firm, the investment firm that you set up with Alan.
Mm-hmm.
And that finally gives you both the stage and the resources that you need
And the experience.
Yes,
because actually, you can't fight a battle until you actually know where the pressure points are and the language. You have to me, it's all very well battling an issue. You need to also then find the solutions. And so unless you have the experience, you can't come up with the solution. So I'm very much more focused on not just the battle, but finding the solutions. And that's what I've done with all my campaigning, is try and put forward solutions to whatever the issue is.
But within 5 years, you're advising the Labour Party on what should be in their manifesto?
Well, even before that, because we started the business in 2009.
Right.
In 2012, I started something called the True and Fair Campaign.
Yes.
And this year, I've actually managed to get text into three EU directives, two that came in earlier this year, and one, the shareholder directive, that comes in next year. So I very quickly, again, fearlessly, I suppose, now you've said it, I couldn't get anywhere in the UK after the 2015 election, because that's the win. I thought, we've got the reforms into the manifesto. But then, of course, Labour didn't win the election. And so then I had to almost start again. So I went cross-party, saw everybody, realised that actually the city was not going to change.
Well, some of this stuff made enemies in the city, didn't it?
A lot of it.
Yes.
Because what I was calling for was basically the level of transparency and reform I was calling for would really dent profit margins.
Yes.
Which it's going to do. And so I just thought, if the UK is not going to do it, I'll go to Europe. And that was my first interaction with Europe. So I started going around all the member states, Europe, lobbying. And what I found was, because I had a plan, not only was I saying there's a problem, but this is the solution.
Right.
most of the doors were open.
Because that's what they want to hear.
Well, I remember going into, there's an organisation called ESMA, who are like the FCA of Europe. So they're like the regulator of the financial services across Europe. Yeah. And I remember going into a meeting there, and Alan was with me. So he presented the problem and I presented the solution. And the guy across the table just looked at me and said, "Is this Christmas?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, you're giving a solution. How much do you want of it?" And I said, no, I'm just giving it to you."
Yes.
And he said, no, it must be a catch.
Gosh.
I said, no, you can have the algorithms, you can have everything we've built, the underlying, you just have it. And they just couldn't believe it. So, of course, they would embrace it. So we were able to do it in a pretty short space of time.
Still, at this point, it hadn't really occurred to you that if you got it enshrined in European Union law, it still might not involve Britain. Back to Gina in just a moment. But before that, have a listen to this.
Hi, Russell Kane here, and I'm hosting a brand new podcast for Joe, Boys Don't Cry, where I get a bunch of men together and force them to talk about the things we never talk about. Body hair, body shape, why do girls only fancy bastards? All the things we worry about but never discuss. Oh, and I'll also have a girl helping me each week just to make sure we're not talking rubbish. So go to wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes, wherever, and download Boys Don't Cry now.
Cheers, Russell. Now, back to Gina Miller. The Brexit stuff then?
Yep.
Followed on from that?
Yes.
I see. That's the missing piece of the jigsaw. So it gave you an understanding you didn't have previously of the supranational power of European Union legislation and bodies.
Absolutely, because when I was there, because I was meeting with all the consumer groups, and I knew that consumer protection and rights were just at the top of their agenda.
Right.
And I didn't know that before, but I was going around to all the member states, I was lobbying all the member states, and that's when I really began to understand the workings of the EU.
And that's when, in the run-up to the referendum, you became profoundly frustrated by the ignorance on both sides.
Yes, on both sides.
That's another missing piece of the jigsaw, isn't it? You're not some sort of arch Remainer who thinks that the Remain campaign was brilliant. The Remain campaign arguably was considerably worse than the Leave.
Look, with my pure marketing head on,
go on.
The Leave campaign wins.
Oh, hands down.
It was one of the best market. You can't. And the Leave side didn't actually.
If you leave your conscience
learn.
At the door, it's a brilliant campaign.
No. If you leave your conscience and your moral compass at the door, yes, it was a brilliant campaign. And I think there was complacency. No institution works if people aren't alert. And I think that's a thing on both sides you have to understand. And the EU side is not perfect, and neither is the UK side. But everyone pretended it was an either-or
It's
faux binary. It wasn't a binary choice.
So when did you decide that you had to get involved in the Article 50 issue? Where did that come from?
So one of my hobbies.
Yes. You have time for hobbies.
I'm obsessive about. Okay. The law is still something I'm very passionate about.
Yes.
So I read Hansard. It's really sad. So I've been reading Hansard for years now, and I've been very concerned at how much the Henry VIII... I was aware of the Henry VIII powers all the way back to 2014-15.
Okay, gosh.
And I realised that the Labour Party were using it too.
Yes,
so successive governments have been using it. And the Hansard Society in particular, I was reading a lot of their articles and their concerns. So I was well aware of the royal prerogative. So I actually knew what it meant.
Gosh. Way before the prospect of it being employed
completely
to
before
accelerate.
That. Yeah, no.
So as soon as it popped up on the horizon with...
I was alarmed immediately.
So what do you do? Who do you ring? I mean, how did you and these other two end up...
But this is the thing. Faith is incredible. You see, this is all supposed to happen. This is why I say I'm exactly the right place I'm supposed to be. Because Mish Kondra, who at the law firm, I was not a client of theirs and no intention, but months before, on the Monday after the referendum, so that would have been the 26th.
Yes.
On the Monday, I was booked to do an event at their offices.
Right.
Talking about lack of diversity in the city and why equality is not working and all this sort of stuff. And I walked into a packed room and in my usual way said a few controversial things on the stage. And one of the senior partners said to me, so is there anything afterwards, drinks and things? He said, oh, is there anything else you're passionate about? At which point I just gave him about 10-minute sort of diatribe about nothing was going to happen unless we had an act. And I just gave him all the legal concerns I had. And he looked at me, sort of really bemused me and sort of smiled all the way through my conversation and said, we have the same concerns, Gina.
Gosh.
We're lawyers. We have the same concerns. We're thinking of drafting a letter. Would you like to come in and we'll tell you what it is we're doing? Because we need a client. Because even though we're lawyers,
we need
a litigant.
Representing somebody. What would have happened if you hadn't turned up, if you'd been sick that day?
I think what may have happened is that because they were...
Their point of view, from yours. How would you have actioned your concerns?
Oh, no, I was already writing letters to all the Labour MPs I knew because I was a member of the Labour Party saying, you aware of and printed out on that weekend all the arguments from Hansard, which I was going to send. So I'd already decided I was going to send them to everybody.
So it escalates quite quickly.
Yep.
You, and again, people won't realise this, you were appointed by the court to be the lead claimant. So I can't imagine you were particularly perturbed by that, now that I know you're a little better. But
it wasn't,
you weren't putting your hand up for it. You weren't seeking to be a figurehead.
No, because what happened, there was a hairdresser, as he called, DeSantos, who had already filed a case which was slightly different to ours.
But born of similar concerns.
Similar concerns, not exactly. But there were four others.
Right. And these were what you might call democracy geeks.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what you have in common with these people. You're democracy geeks who feel that the public are unaware of what's been ridden roughshod over.
Yeah, and rights and all. So they were geeks. So there were four or five other cases, and then there was our case.
Right,
and Lord Levinson suddenly announced, after hearing the presentation, if you like, from the lead counsel in each one, QCs, he suddenly makes a ruling on the 19th of July. So we're all sitting there. Last thing I expect is that we're all sitting together. We'll be together.
Yeah.
And then he says he's appointing a lead claimant, Mrs. Miller, and I remember it so clearly. I always will do. I was looking at my phone at the time.
Yeah.
Very naughty.
Really?
Not supposed to have
contempt.
I know exactly. That's why I'm saying it really quietly. I was actually looking at my phone, and I heard him say Mrs. Miller, and I sort of looked up, and then my QC David Panic, he sort of leaned over and whispered, and he said, "We're a lead claimant," and I went, "What the hell does that mean?"
And what did he say?
He said, "I'll tell you later."
And you found out.
And I found out
subsequently.
Later. But so, it was,
this is where it gets surreal, of course.
Yeah, it's completely surreal.
I mean, much of it already is, but this is where you become public enemy number one for the Daily Mail and sundry fellow travellers for taking personal and professional action designed to protect parliamentary sovereignty. Mm. So against the backdrop of all these people bleating about sovereignty,
it was the very thing they were talking about.
Okay, here's a challenge for you. That was a marketing failure on your part, wasn't it? Why couldn't you persuade all of these people that you were actually the one on the side of sovereignty and they were the ones that were backing attempts to undermine
it? Because from day one, those right-wing press already called it the anti-Brexit case, and I was the anti-Brexit. They tarred me in the case. Yeah. It was very difficult because actually it wasn't a case about our constitution. It was the anti-Brexit case.
Yes, of course.
And that's the minute I walked out of that courtroom, that's how they started it.
When did you realise just how egregious a target you had on your back?
Later that day, on the 19th of July.
So soon?
Yes, because what happened was the law firm got targeted, and then a Facebook posting went up with a swastika on my forehead. And so it started straight away. It started literally that afternoon. And when I got back to the office, I remember my office being quite quiet because my staff, the email boxes were already filling up. It started immediately.
Were you scared?
I was phased. I didn't quite understand. Because to me, as you've just said, I was thinking, hang on a minute, I'm bringing a case about the Constitution and naively.
You perhaps underestimated other people's interest in the niceties of Hansard and the law.
I think the minute they called it the anti-Brexit case and people, you know,
displayed a degree of ignorance as well. Do you think the ignorance was willful? Do you think they knew better and chose to paint it like
that? No, I don't think. I think people just thought, we're going to lose our win.
It was so entrenched by now that everything was the enemy. That's how high court judges end up being the enemies of the people.
Oh, no, everything is toxic.
God. What's the difference between phased and frightened?
So, okay, to explain that. So the 19th of July, this all happens. The court case is going to be in October. So that whole summer, the idea was to destroy me. And I know this, I've been told this, is that because if they had broken me, I was a lead claimant. There'd be no case. Mm. It would be one of the other cases and they would be delayed or whatever it is. And, you know, Article 50 would be triggered. So the idea was to break me. And that's in that summer when the death threat started against me, the children. I just said to my husband, because I had to negotiate this with him, I said, I have to carry on because this can't allow it to be happening. And actually what happened that summer that changed in me was I realized what I was fighting for. I was fighting to stop those people who were hating me and trying to, they could not ever become mainstream.
No.
And that was my fight.
So in fact, I mean, Article 50 subsequently triggered, albeit that you won your court case, that some people might seek to portray that as evidence that you'd been wasting your time.
Yeah.
But by then your cause, your mission was different from the simple.
And it carries
sovereignty.
On to be. This is a country that I love and I grew up with as being the best in the world. And I'm not going to see it destroyed. So I'm going to fight
these forces of hatred.
By these forces of hatred. You know, I cannot abdicate my responsibility. I just can't.
If This is what we should expect from immigrants. Send them back to their stinking jungles. £5,000 for the first person to accidentally run over this bloody troublesome first-generation immigrant. This was a chap called Rodri Phillips who was sentenced to 12 weeks in prison. I mention it solely to give anybody unaware of...
A Viscount.
Of this. Yes, he was a fourth Viscount St. David's, a flavour of what you were exposed to. But I sense that despite the fact that this is one that came to court and ended in a prison sentence, this was far from remarkable.
No, that was actually one of the least threatening in a way, because we could go after him. But there are what's called cease and desist letters. There were 8 of those. But when they're bounced around the world, the police can't find this thing. So some of the ones that came from the dark web, for example, of, you know, you will cut your kids' throats and you'll watch them, whatever it is, those ones you can never find.
How do you decide? Because actually, I guess you hadn't been exposed to it much prior to this happening, but I have, oddly. And I dismiss almost all of it as fantasists and idiots. How do you make the distinction between the ones that need to be taken seriously? Or do you take them all seriously because one of them will be for real?
It's very hard.
Yes.
So what I decided to do is I had to take them all seriously because I have 3 children.
Okay. Yeah, of course.
So I decided that the only way was to change my life.
Which meant security.
Security, not going out as much. Everything about our lives changed. So now we have a debate every time we go out.
And your husband is absolutely part of this.
Oh, he has to be.
Well, I know he does, but the first marriage, it was the fact that you forgot about
it. Yes, no. Now, what I've learned, actually, is that I have to share everything about my own ambitions, and he has to be part of that, because I'm not going to let that failure repeat itself. So I did learn from the mistakes of not including my husband in my fights. But it has changed the way we live our lives, and the conversations we have with the children are possibly bizarre. And we use humour a lot of the time because it's the only way to get through it.
Yes.
But we do have some really strange conversations.
And I mean, this is the point at which I should remind people that everything we've discussed is covered in your new book.
Yes.
There must have been times, surely. And I've got a horrible feeling you're going to say, no, not at all. When you just thought, right, I'd like to stop now. I'd like to give back my involvement and just go back to how we were before.
I absolutely. And there are times when I thought, what am I doing to our family? I can't. I mean, the fact is they have to read this. When my son once read something by mistake, a friend showed him on social media about his mother and a photograph. And,
because we can't stress enough how vile the stuff. I mean, everything you could expect to be said, A, about a woman, B, about a person of colour, C, about...
It's unbelievable. And so I had to think about that. And then my husband just sort of smiled and laughed at me when I said that, because he said, you're just tired. Just go to sleep, because you wake up in the morning and tell me that in the morning.
And your dream will be back.
So I went to bed, woke up in the morning, and I said, yeah, you're absolutely right. Of course I'm not. It's just pure exhaustion.
But it's the children of the window, aren't they? They're the way in. That's the stuff that makes you question.
And, you know, I say to them all the time, and I tell them everything I'm doing, and they just say, but, Mum, you're doing it for us. They know that. They know I'm doing it for them. But the other thing is, the humour thing is, you know, I'll put on in the weekends, my dark glasses and my running cap and my running gear so I don't look like me. I'm like work Gina, as they call it. And they go, Mum, you do know you look exactly the same.
Great disguise, Mum.
So they just, but it's great, you know. And
you need that.
Yeah, no, we do. Or, you know, we were playing Monopoly this weekend and they were cheating. And they said, Mum, when you weren't at home so much, we couldn't cheat at these games with you because you never had time to play with us.
But it's the strange thing. You are an optimistic person. I don't know quite how that has been sustained. Your optimism shines through even after the country has done something that there's no secret, we both consider to be an act of absolute idiocy. You've seen a side of humanity that perhaps you didn't appreciate existed before. For me, it's not the existence of the horror. It's the number of people that are comfortable with it, the number of people that will join in, given an opportunity.
It's become acceptable.
To revivify these ancient prejudices that we felt we'd seen away, at least for generations, if not forever. And yet you are still optimistic.
Oh, absolutely.
How?
Because I believe in people. I think we are fundamentally good. And actually, one of the things I miss most about my life now is I can't people watch. Mm. And one of my guilty pleasures used to be just sitting on the tube and watching people. People are amazing. And when it comes down to it, we really do love each other. And that's why I have hope.
And when you mentioned that you can't do that anymore.
No, so I can't do that anymore.
We talked about the social media stuff. What sort of stuff do you encounter in public, as it were?
Well, I'm always on tenterhooks, which is exhausting. So I'm always sort of on listening. because the abuse that I get shouted at me, or threats of acid attacks, or, you know, even with the children. Mm. And that's why I don't go out with them as much, because even with them there, people will shout the most vile things to me.
Has it got better? Or is it?
It goes in waves.
Okay.
Now,
depending on the news cycle.
Yes, not only the news cycle, but it depends what other people say, because apparently I'm so powerful now that I'm behind all sorts of things.
Right. When George Soros is busy.
Yeah, when George Soros is busy, which is quite extraordinary, because I've never had a penny from Soros, but apparently he's funded me and I'm a puppet. All these sorts of things. And I think, so if somebody says something, a politician or a business or whatever, apparently it's my fault.
Oh, I see.
It's extraordinary. So then there'll be another wave. I remember some advice a PR agent gave me in early days. She said, Gina, you need to go away now and let things cool down and come back. And I just looked at her and said, why? Why would I allow myself to be bullied into silence? I'm never going to let that happen.
Gina Miller, thank you. I did warn you that I was in danger of being a bit of a fanboy in that interview, and absolutely nothing happened during the course of it to alter that position. Although, like you, I now know an awful lot more about the author of Rise, Life Lessons in Speaking Out, Standing Tall and Leading the Way than I did before. If you enjoyed that, looking under the bonnet, if you like, of people who have quite a high public profile in politics, you might want to check out the Nick Clegg episode of Unfiltered. Here's a little clip.
People say stuff, and it's, I always think psychologically it's like road rage. When people say stuff, feel stuff, splutter stuff behind the wheel, and indeed, of course, behind a keyboard, that you would never, ever say to another human being. I remember, I'm sure he didn't, maybe didn't know what he was saying. I'm sure he's a perfectly nice bloke, I don't know him, but I remember there was a Labour MP when I was in coalition, and obviously the whole Labour narrative was all, you know, how dare you, Judas Iscariot, you've sold out, but all that kind of. And I remember him, this was Barry Gardiner, and he was like red, and he almost spat out across the Commons. I remember saying, "You are a Quisling." And I thought, does he know what that means? Mm. That is a Nazi collaborator.
Yes, yes.
I thought, maybe he just doesn't know what it means, but, you know, it has got to the point where people. Here's the thing. I don't think people feel they need to worry anymore about the words they use.
So do go back and check that out, along with the rest of the back catalogue. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to Unfiltered and to leave a rating and a review on iTunes. And of course, if you know someone who you think might like Unfiltered, make your good deed for the day telling them about it.
You're listening to Unfiltered with James O'Brien, brought to you by Joe.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.